Okay. We know it's wrong, and because it's wrong, we had to just say so, and that's what we're suggesting to the Congress, that can't decide on anything. So I said, Mr. President, John should tell you that you didn't just appoint three Democrats, three Republicans. You appointed six fishermen, and we wrote this report up at Land O'Lakes, Wisconsin. And he said, God, you catch a lot of fish? I said, we've cleaned the place out practically. But I said, he said, could I go up there? And I said, of course. And we did arrange for him to go up, but then something came up overseas, and his brother Milton and his father-in-law went up fishing there. But they caught a lot of walleye, and they brought them back, and I cooked them in the White House kitchen. Finish out that part of the story. Well, through all of this ups and downs and political pressure and not being very popular in many parts of the country, John kept the thing going solidly. And Ike was so impressed that he talked the Congress into renewing us for another 2 or 3 years. And that went on for the next 10 years, with John always being the chair. When Nixon came in, we had, been pretty obstreperous to a lot of people. But John, by that time, the old governors had died, and I was the only original one with John still alive. And John decided to pack it in, so he went down to become secretary for all overseas aid, AID, Agency for International Development. And he had earlier taken a stint in Washington as the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower. So he knew the ropes, and he operated very well in that because he knew his way around. He knew how to get done what he needed to get done. But when he left, I'm the only original member left, so I went to see President Nixon right after he was elected in the White House. And I said, I think I better resign. I've been on this 10 years, and I'm the last living member. John's living, but he's working for another part of the government. And I said, I really should give you my resignation right now. He said, well, let me think about it, will you? So he called me back a week later and said, well, I want you to be chairman. I said, well, that's hardly resigning. So I took John's place for the next 4 years. And 4 years later, after the election, I got fired because we were really leaning on the administration pretty hard, on especially employment. They had the enormous employment in Washington, and we took all the 40 biggest agencies like the Pentagon and FBI and Secretary of State, and just took their own statistics. They had to keep, part of our law was they had to keep the race figures. And it turned out that of the 40 top employers in Washington, all the government agencies, we're talking here about millions of employees, only one, health, education, welfare in those days, got a category. Our categories were poor, fair, good, and outstanding. We got no outstanding, no good, and one bottom of the line, fair, health, education, welfare, and the other 39 were poor on the record. So the law that the federal government had pushed through wasn't even being observed by the federal government. I think that was probably the can tied to me that assured that I would be fired, which I was. But it turned out to be kind of a badge of honor to be fired. And
yes.
And so I remember so well, I wasn't on the job very long when they told me they wanted to put a guy in for chairman. I mean, for staff director. He was the really right-hand guy. John always made sure we had a good staff director. This guy I wanted to put on had been assistant staff director, and the other guy was going back to practice law. So I told him at the White House I wanted this fellow to be my staff director. And they asked me to come over to lunch. And I remember so well, they had the chief political operator in the White House and another guy very close on the staff there, plus Pat Moynihan and myself, four of us, to lunch. Or I guess it was actually dinner, but it doesn't matter. We were at the White House staff room. And Pat Moynihan gave it away. He said, "Battery, you better be ready for it. They're going to have to talk you out of your the guy you want to be staff director." And I said, I really feel that I need a strong guy that I can count on. They said, "We got a strong guy you can count on." They brought up a guy over in Virginia who had gotten a couple of congressmen elected, and this was going to be his payback for what he had done politically. So I said, "Well, I'm not happy about this, but I'll have lunch with the guy," which I did, and it turned out he was a nice guy, but no law degree, and he'd be a really weak sister in this job. So I said, "Where do I go from here?" So I went over to John's office in the State Department. I remember sitting in his office saying, "What do I do, John?" And he said, "You know, Father Ted," he said, "you got more oomph than you think or realize. You just pick up that phone and call this political guy in the White House and tell him that he's got a simple choice. He accepts your recommendation that this guy is staff director because you have to work with him. He's your top guy. Or if not, you better go out and get another chairman because you're resigning and you're going to tell Mr. Nixon that you're resigning because of this guy's action." Well, this guy went up the flu, you know, and he said, "Boy, you're talking tough." I said, "Well, I'm being coached by a guy who knows how to talk tough when you have to. But that's the way it is." And I'm calling on John's telephone. Didn't tell him who it was. And finally the guy said, "Well, yeah, we don't want to lose you, so go ahead, appoint Glickstein," which is what I did. And it worked out very well. But John really saved the day because I didn't feel like going back to president and arguing with him, but that's the only way it was going to end. But John was kind of a mentor. We were both university presidents during this whole time. But he was a model of how to get tough things through a committee. He probably was used to working with a committee of trustees at Michigan. He used to regale me with some of his problems there. But he was a guy that had great vision, and I think he took a place that was little regarded and in a matter of fairly short time made it one of the first-class universities so that he could stand up with the University of Michigan and say, "We're as good as you are." Now, Michigan had a lot longer time in history, but by golly, I'd say today you would have to say there's some very close calls if you compare the two institutions. Mm-hmm. I've ranged a long way, but sooner or later this stuff would have to come out. So that's, I hope it's useful to you.
It sure is. The your work, in looking back at your work on the Civil Rights Commission, is there any legislation that you can point to that maybe has the most important impact of that?
I would say, I said earlier that we finally decided we're getting nowhere on anything, so we put the whole thing into one package and we took it to Mr. Kennedy and the president. Of course, he handed over to Bobby, who was his attorney general and really guiding all the civil rights stuff. And they were really bearing down on him. Kennedy was in an awkward position there because in those days they had a solid South and he had a real scraper of an election. And all he had to do was to get tough on civil rights, and you could be darn sure he would lose the solid South, and he'd only have one term in the White House. And everybody that walks in that Oval Office wants to stay there 8 years, and he was no exception. So I think his strategy was that he'd hold off for 4 years, and then the last term it didn't matter, he could get tougher. But he never got a chance, because he was knocked off, you know, in 3 years. And Johnson came in, and Johnson's been much maligned as a president in a lot of biographies they've written about him. And I have to say that I always admired the guy because he was really concerned about the poor, as he'd been poor growing up in South Texas along the Pedregales. And he knew what it was to be hungry and what it was to have to work like a dog for very little pay. And he really empathized with the blacks in America because they were getting a terrible shrift on all of the key points like education and housing and employment and voting and so forth. But especially public accommodations where they couldn't walk down the street in Atlanta and take a drink out of the fountain because it was only for whites, even though blacks get thirsty too. Couldn't go to the toilet anywhere, which gets embarrassing if you're shopping in a big city. You couldn't go in and just buy something, try it on. They wouldn't let you try anything on. You couldn't even go in the drugstore and get a Coke and sit down and drink it. You could get one and take it out on the street and drink it, maybe. But that was, we called in general, public accommodations, and that was terrible. So Johnson, right after he got elected, got together with us and said he's going to break this power lock, if you or power grid. And he went in and called a joint session of Congress in January. He only came in November. And he called them there in January, and he said, we're going to finally make Jefferson's dream come true, that all Americans are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And he said, that isn't happening today. They can't even vote, much less all of those other things, like going to a good school. Segregation is by law, the old Plessy Ferguson decision. And he said, we're going to pass this. And he took the law that we had a terrible time getting Kennedy just to drop in the bucket up on the hill. And he pulled it out and made it even tougher, and then shoved it back in. And this was his special meeting of both houses. So this is the most important thing for the country, and we're going to do it. And I don't want a lot of mucking around. Now, there was no way on earth that that could happen, except that he had been head of the House and head of the Senate. And he knew those guys. He knew their foibles. And he knew their sins. And he'd call up a guy from one of the southern states and say, George, I hear you're not going to vote for my bill. Now it became my bill. And George said, well, Lyndon, you know, I vote for that bill, and I'm dead politically. And he said, who are they going to put in and take your place? Where'd they get all those bridges and all of that big university help and those airports? And what about those highways? They got them because you're head of the committee. They're going to drop you off? No way they can do that. It takes 20, 30 years to get to be head of a committee. And the guy would say, well, I don't know. You can say that, Lyndon, but I got to go to the election. Lyndon would say, how do you think it would happen? What would people speculate if there was an article in the New York Times or in the Washington Post next week saying, what is Senator X doing, and your name would be X. He said, what is Senator X doing in room 340 of the Mayflower Hotel every Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock? We don't think he's up there to say the Our Father. And you know, he said, you wouldn't do it, my God, you blow up my family and my reputation. He'd say, you better vote for my bill. Well, by July, which was unthinkable, just to create the commission, it took them all summer. And then they did it as a way of getting out of doing anything else, take their problem and dump it on us. Anyway, in July, he signed that bill. And I swear to you, there's no president before or since who could have got that bill through, except Lyndon Johnson did it by sheer force and pushing and even bullying, which I don't mind if he's bullying people that won't vote for justice. So
this is the Voting Rights Act of
1964. You're right. And another that was actually the Omnibus Civil Rights Bill of 1964, and then they had the Voting Rights came in 65, although it was included, a good part of it, in the first bill. But the first bill does change the face of America, and you can thank John Hanifer in large measure for that happening, because he gave leadership for a little weak commission that amounted to nothing. And every time we got out of a report, they never found us on a single fact. John was fierce that this had to be factual. This had to be what the witness said. It had to be, and we say we had a tape of every single word that was said in these hearings, and we had almost 100 hearings over the years. And we put out a lot of books. So I am very grateful to have seen his leadership at work during all those years, and steadfastly and with great courage and never ducking a problem. And one other thing about him that I think kind of endeared him to the rest of us, staff, of course, would get caught up with great fury on some of these things, and they'd put out a sentence like, the inexorable condition of voting is abominable in everybody's eyes who thinks it all about justice. And John would say, I think that sentence would be stronger if we left out all the adverbs and all the adjectives. And you know, in a way it was simple. not to allow people to vote is great injustice if they happen to be American citizens. But John was simple in that sense, you know. He didn't want to have a lot of embellishment because the facts spoke for themselves, and that was what was going to make the difference, not the adjectives and the adverbs. People could add their own.
Did you have any later contact with him?
Well, we became great friends, and of course, I traveled with him at times when we coincided in Japan and Okinawa and Philippines. I used to kid him and say that the sun never sets on Michigan State University because it had these wonderful programs all over the world, and he was very big on that, and he'd go out himself and make sure they're working. That's why he made such a great administrator for our international program in the whole country, because he knew it. One really funny one, he could get, you know, he was a very balanced, good guy, but he could get his dander up.
Because how did you do that?
It wasn't against me, but I remember a few times during those hearings when someone would press pretty close to the bone and he'd say, "Now, we're here to get the truth, not to spout propaganda. And what you said just is not true, and I have to be expunged from the record." But this time I saw him turned off right away was he and his wife, who's a lovely lady, and I were in the Philippines. We'd been in Okinawa together at a meeting, and we both had business in the Philippines, mostly with alumni. And we were staying at the Hotel Manila, and we go into the dining room that night. I had a collar on, and he was dressed up with a shirt and tie and coat, of course, because the weather was kind of hot. But we had appropriate clothes for that. We get to the dining room, and the maitre d' was a little guy about 4.5 feet tall, Filipino. He says to me, "You can't go in." And I said, "Why not?" And he says, "You don't have a tie on." That really put John through the ceiling. He said, you damn fool. He's a Catholic priest. Catholic priests don't wear ties. They wear what they call a Roman collar, and he's got it on, and that's his formal wear. Now get out of the way. And the little guy said, "No tie, no get in." And I knew this was going to not end in peace. So I said, "John, you got an extra tie?" And he said, "Yeah." So we told his wife, "Go and grab a table," and we went up to the room, and I got a tie from him. Actually, it was a black tie, so I put on a shirt and put the tie on, came down. So at the end of the evening, I took it off and said, "John, thanks a lot." And he said, "Looks good on you. Keep it." And I think I still have that tie.
Interesting story. Why do you think Hannah was a selected chair first time?
Well, I don't know. I don't know why I was selected. I know I was selected chair. Eisenhower just put him in his chair.
Okay.
Because Eisenhower probably saw him perform when in the Department of Defense. But I'm sure it was Eisenhower's judgment, because he had the right of appointment, and he also appointed the chair.
Oh, I see. I didn't know if it was elected.
You know, well, another thing was the three others were Democrats, and John was a Republican, so that was probably another reason. His choice was the black guy. At that time, might not have washed, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I was the only other choice, and it was unusual to put a priest in his chair. But Nixon did it.
If go back a little bit to a little different focus at Michigan State, obviously one of the long-standing relationships has been intercollegiate athletics between the two schools. You want to just sort of share some of your thoughts about what that's meant, both pro and con, as far as for both schools and the relationship?
I think it's been a very healthy relationship. We've never had any fuss. Well, occasionally the kids get worked up at games, but that's part of the atmosphere. And I've been was present for 35 years, so I had went the whole gamut of John and his next four successors, including the current man. I was a good friend of all of them. In fact, I'm still on committees with DiBiagio, the Knight Commission on the Future of Intercollegiate Athletics, and also the man you just honored was on that.
Clifton Horton?
Yeah, Cliff Horton is also on that commission.
Right.
And I can think of nothing but positive, peaceful things that happened between our two schools. I mean, we We've shared professors at times, interchange. I mean, they'd hire someone or they'd hire somebody from here. We have, when I was president, I used to always go up there for the games and stay with John and his wife. I went up this year after a long absence because Pete was a good friend of mine years ago before he got this job. He was involved in a number of pro bono things, and he'd been up there quite a few years. It's amazing how they slide by. And I hadn't even been up there, and I hadn't seen him in about 6-7 years. So he wrote me last year and said, would you come up for the game this year? And I generally don't go to away games. Even when I was president, Father Joyce did that. But I thought I'd better go up and see him. And I thought he was doing very well. But we've had very good academic relationships. We, I think, have been totally cooperative on both sides whenever that was called for. And a number of our youngsters here have gotten their advanced degrees from Michigan State. Every time I go up, I meet several of them. And we have always been helpful to each other any way possible, which is not true all the time.
One of the coaches during that time period was Duffy Doherty.
Dear guy. He gave our football banquet talk almost every year.
At one time, there was a move, if the record's correct, to try and hire him for Notre Dame. Is that true?
I can't say that's true. First of all, he was doing such a splendid job, but he loved this place, and he used to come down almost every year and talk at our football banquet. And he was a very wonderful speaker and a great guy. But I know the only time I hired someone from a Big Ten school was when I got Eric Parsegian from Northwestern. But before even talking to Eric Parsegian, I called the president up there, Rocky Miller, and said, Rocky, we're going to need a new coach, and we're looking with great envy at Eric Parsegian, but I won't even talk to him if you don't say it's okay with you. He said, Ted, you're the only guy I know that doesn't go hunting without a license. He said, of course you're. He said, he's not going to stay here. He's had his run here, and it's been wonderful, but if you want to talk to him, go ahead. I think he'd be a great coach for Notre Dame. So I don't honestly remember trying to hire Duffy Doherty, although I must say we had very close relationships with him. And Father Ned Joyce was my executive vice president for all the 35 years I was president, and he mostly came up with the people for replacement. And coaches are funny, you know, you get a great one, then one isn't quite that great, then you get another great one. It's an up and down kind of business. But Duffy was a great coach and a wonderful person. Another friend we had up there, of course, was Father Mack, who was, yes. He would have shot us or poisoned us if we went after Duffy, I think.
He was a very strong supporter.
Oh, yeah.
The game that our people remember, of course, is the 1966.
Yeah, I was at that 10-10 game.
10-10 tie. Any comments you would like to share with us?
Well, it was, I can only tell you what I got from our coach afterwards. Everything went wrong. Our first quarterback went down. Our best runner,
I know.
He, of all things, getting off the train, fell down and bumped his knee and couldn't play. In the game, towards the end, as you remember, it was tied and we had the ball. But the guy we had in as quarterback, Coley O'Brien, I believe it was had just been diagnosed, never knew it, with diabetes the week before. And Aaron didn't really want to put him in. But at the end, he lost the quarterback that was the quarterbacking, and Coley was all he had left that knew the plays and the formations and things. But he was, with the diabetes, he was seeing triple. His eyesight was under great pressure, and he was, it's nothing like a blind man throwing a pass. You've got to see who's out there and where he is and who's guarding him. So he had one of two choices, to just play it safe and run it into the ground for 3 or 4 plays, and that was the end of the game, or having this guy who wasn't in full control of his vision throw it out there and get it intercepted and run for a score, and that's the end of it. As you recall, the next week they really worked hard on Coley and got his vision straightened out. And the following week he beat Southern Cal something like 55-0.
Right.
And we became national champions that year. But it looked like it wasn't a sporting thing, at least to try a Hail Mary pass or something. But that was, it was Coley O'Brien was the key to the whole explanation, as I got it from the coach.
That's very interesting.
It drove Aaron nuts because everybody was always bringing that up. They didn't think anything else he did was good.
A national championship.
Yeah.
Forgot the other thing.
There's been some great rivalries in some of the other sports, too. Basketball, for example.
Yeah.
And from my perspective, the toughest game that Michigan State played when they won the national championship in 1979 was against Notre Dame. Do you have any remembrances or comments about that aspect of the sport?
Not really. I mean, what I did here, I had Father Ned take care of all the athletic. He was had the job that I had when I was executive vice president. He was chairman of the board of for the administration of athletics here, and he ran a tight ship, and we went all those years without any real serious trouble, and a few incidents that we had to live with and take care of. But by and large, he was so good at it that I didn't even go to any away games. I just I go to games here, but we always felt Michigan State was like a brother. We never. I say there are a few schools around, which I will leave unmentioned, but we didn't quite feel that way about.
You alluded briefly to the Knight Commission and that aspect.
Yeah. Well, you got two former presidents. Of
right,
the,
Wharton and DiBiagio.
On that and commission.
How do you think the Knight Commission is going to proceed at this point in time?
Well, the last time we wanted to clean up the internal administration, we got the presidents back in charge of the NCAA and the faculty. We really had a simple program that the president had to be in charge. I call it 1+3. The president had to clearly be in charge. You couldn't have anything done in that, you know, top things in athletics without his knowledge and his approval. He didn't have to do them personally, but he could. He had to be on top of them. What was he mostly on top of? First, academic. He didn't allow the school to accept kids that weren't capable of doing the work. And secondly, he didn't accept and run play kids that weren't made doing the work. And thirdly, a majority of his kids ought to graduate. And he didn't want any more hanky-panky courses. So we said the president first has to be sure that the academic side of the organization is right. And then the second one was finances, that all finances had to go through the normal course of finance spending at a university. There couldn't be anything on the outside in a booster club or money coming in from an outside to the inside. And that everything had to be accounted for in the university financial setup. And lastly, he ought to feel strong enough about this that he's willing to have a team from the NCAA come in every 5 years and give them a complete look, and they would have access to all the financial reports, all the coaches, all the athletic director or directors, if they had a couple, president, players. It was a complete open book, and it had to be done every 5 years, and that passed. About 92% of our recommendations passed. Now we think the pressure is often coming from outside the organization. It gets back to money, but it's gambling, it's drugs, and it's anything that has money involved in it, enormous coaches' salaries, which you think is wrong, probably too much in the way of schedule, and so the last meeting we had, we spent a day and a half listening to everybody, the NCAA, all the conferences, and including Big Ten, the students, players, coaches, athletic directors. We just went through the gamut and had them all just tell us what they thought was good and bad about it. We'll have a few more meetings, and then we're going to have to get a report. I suspect we'll set up some kind of a institution, if you will, or a group of people who can do this on a constant basis. We're all retired guys, and we're coming back to do this, but I've had enough of it.
In your work on the commission, Did you find that President DiBiagio and Horton?
Oh yeah.
Their work. Did they speak from a knowledge base of what had happened to them and how athletics affected their administration?
No question. They didn't quote Michigan State or where he is now, Tufts, of course, or New York in the case of
Cliff
Wharton. But they are both, I'd say they're two of the more important members, and it's obvious because they know what they're talking about.
The contacts that you had with our current president, Peter McPherson, do you remember when those began?
Probably 10 years ago, but we kept crisscrossing on different things. I belonged to, when I was in my full flight, to about 30 different organizations. And I don't remember exactly which one it was, but it might have been the Council on Foreign Relations, it might have been some of the other academic organizations, because he was never in academia explicitly, but he had a doctor's degree. And anyway, I always liked Peter, and I had seen him over the years, and I was rejoiced at the fact he...